We are doing a very good job of getting rid of the bugs that bug us. But if we do get rid of them all, we will be left with no flowers, no trees, no crops, no food. And so we ask, should we rebug agriculture?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1286th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Aberdeen who are tuned into the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, my first sight of Disneyland was a heartbreaker. I was a Montana boy sitting in the back of the bus on the way from Long Beach Naval Base to the San Diego Naval Base when right there, amidst the gray-brown smog rolling off I-5, was Disneyland's signature Matterhorn. Having consumed a lot of Disney in my formative years, to the extent of once being smitten by the Mickey Mouse Club's Annette Funicello, I had to come to believe that Disney's Matterhorn would somehow be a real deal, not a diminutive fiberglass fake. Then later, after a date at Disneyland, I was overcome by the nihilistic belief that all of Disneyland's attractions were fake. No longer able to find amusement in the fake attractions, I never bought another ticket to Disneyland. That's probably to my detriment when it gets right down to it. Nevertheless, I mention my disappointment because I see so much of our world being turned into synthetic fakery, including our food. Look at the Impossible Burger in the grocer's meat cooler. It's not a meat at all. It's ground up plant matter, glued together with patented chemical compounds so as to look and taste like meat. It should be called Matterhorn meat. While shopping around for ways of putting real back into the world, I was introduced to a book entitled Rebugging the Planet by the UK's Vicky Hurd. Her proposal that we rebug the planet leads me to ask, should we rebug agriculture? Who better to ask than the lady with the proposal? She is Vicky Hurd, CEO of the Alliance for Better Food and Farming, and the author of Rebugging the Planet. Vicky, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good to be here. And where's here for you?
Here is in London, North London in the UK.
I was wondering about English people and their propensity and their proclivity for horticulture and gardening and anything to do with gardening. What do you think it is that?
It's a really good question because we do have an obsession, you could call it, for gardening and for perfect lawns and pristine borders. And I don't know, it's just been for many centuries, I think, the affluent who had land in which they could do that have been doing it. And now it's a very big obsession, and there's big bucks spent on plants and all the chemicals that people use to keep them free of bugs. I think there is also a great movement to start thinking about that, whether it should be so pristine and could it be a bit messier and let the bugs back in.
Yeah.
That's a great movement that I'm trying to promote.
So bring life back to life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Putting life
Nature isn't neat. Yeah, it shouldn't be neat and clean and all monocultures wherever you look. It should be a bit more messy and a bit more wild in many ways.
Well, you captured my attention in the introduction to Rebugging the Planet with an observation that caught my attention, because I guess I've had that same observation, and that has to do with bugs on the windshield.
Yes. You don't see them, do you? When I was young, you'd have to scrape them off the windshield and the lights after a holiday trip or a trip around the countryside, or even in town. And these days, you don't see that at all. It doesn't happen in the UK anyway. And when I talked to my children about it, they didn't know what I was talking about. So they've never seen it.
You know, I'm as a kid, I worked in a gas station, and during those times, you know, when somebody came in for gas, we would check the tires, air in the tires. We'd wash the windshield and so on. And I remember scraping bugs.
Scraping, yes. Scraping the dead bugs.
But you don't have to scrape bugs anymore. Why do we not have to scrape bugs anymore off our windshield?
Yeah, well, we've actually just made life really difficult for an awful lot of bugs. I mean, what we've done is several things. One of the key things is make our countryside very uniform and take away a lot of the habitats on which a lot of the bugs, which made up, you know, both the variety and number of bugs, from bees to moths to beetles, everything. We've made it just difficult for them to live, to move around, to breed, and to recolonize. So they're far fewer in number, and they sort of stick to certain places. So, for instance, going through a very industrial farming area, it's been so zapped with chemicals, and there's such a very uniform crop, which may be good for one or two bugs, and therefore it has to be sprayed a lot to keep those out. But the majority of bugs just don't find it a habitat they can live in, because there's nowhere, you know, they need different places for different stages of their life cycle. And so when you drive through those areas, you don't get the bugs on your windscreen. But I do know places in the UK where you do still get that. A farmer I know in Wales, he keeps getting that, and he says, no, I still have it on my organic farm. I get covered in moths when I drive through and when I walk through. And that's true. I've been on organic farms and pasture-based farms where you still, the insects rise up when you walk through or where you drive through. But the majority, because we've just spent so much time getting rid of the problem insects, we've forgotten about the good stuff.
It's, you know, that's a very interesting observation. It's almost as if agriculture has become a food desert for bugs.
Yes, yes, yes. And you can see why. I mean, most of the money spent on research on insects is research on how to kill them or how to keep them out or, you know, make sure they can't breed or whatever. So, you know, instead of doing the research on what the good bugs could do, we spent so much on what they, how to stop them. And as you say, they've become deserts. So actually, what I found when doing the research for the book, urban areas, your gardens and your parks are actually becoming a real refuge. Even your golf courses are becoming a refuge for the bugs. And they can be quite rich in bugs if you've got the right kind of habitats and lots of different flowering plants, for instance, for the pollinators in your garden or in your parks. There's loads of things in an urban area which actually can be welcoming if done well.
You know,
but that's an irony, isn't it? Because you think the rural areas should have loads of bugs.
Well, there's the irony. I've done a number of shows with beekeepers, and one of the more interesting ones, shows that I do with beekeepers, are those who manage bees in the city, because they're... It's like a feast for them because people grow plants, different kinds of plants. So there's a veritable feast for them. But out there in the countryside, maybe you have 1,000 acres of almond trees or something like that. So that's it. There's nothing else.
Fine. That's it. Yeah, there isn't the diversity. And the wild bees, which are very important pollinators, can't survive in a uniform monoculture of almond trees or wheat fields or even apple trees. You know, it's just not enough variety for the variety of wild bees that could be pollinating. So you have to ship in millions of bees every year to do the pollination. And so it becomes, the bees are really a livestock in many areas, whereas if you actually make it a more diverse farming system, which means changing what we eat ultimately, you know, changing the nature of the farming system, you will actually get the pollination for free.
Yes, and what you're talking about is a major change in how we go about farming and growing our food and whatnot. But going back to the ways in which we get rid of food, we become very adept at spraying pesticides across the land. What is the, how much do we spray? 5.6 billion pounds of pesticides every year to kill the world's bugs.
It's intense, isn't it?
It's simply mind-boggling. So those pesticides do kill bugs.
Yeah. Some kill the bugs. Some make them less able to breed, and so they go elsewhere. And some make them less able to communicate with each other. And other things like herbicides. So you've got pesticides, which might be, you know, you might think of it as insect killing or bug killing, and then you've got the herbicides to kill the weeds. And that can reduce their ability to feed because they haven't got their food plants at certain times of the year. So, yeah, it's sort of that drenching of the countryside has sort of wiped out an awful lot of the insects and other invertebrates like worms and spiders, which are really important pollinators. Spiders are pollinators in themselves, and worms are obviously incredibly important for our soil structures.
For the soil,
They get harmed. Yeah, so there's a lot of bugs under the ground as well as above it, which we should be thinking about.
Well, to the extent we've been conducting this all-out, full-scale war against bugs, have we been how successful have we been?
Not very. We still lose a lot of crops to bugs. And they can, by the nature of bugs, they breed so in such quantities, and they can move around so easily. They can adapt certain numbers of types of bugs when they're generalists, and they can adapt to a new situation. They can evolve into resistant forms. Like, you can get superweeds that can resist herbicides. You can also get bugs that can become resistant to insecticides. Or if you wipe out one bug, you actually leave your crop open to another bug to come in. We're finding that with cotton crops, which have a big problem with cotton boll worm, which is a big issue for cotton crops. If you let it be an issue, if you have really big monocultures and don't have break crops and rotations. And that is being zapped by a genetically engineered version of the cotton crop. But what's happening is we're seeing, as the cotton boll worm can't survive, if it eats the crop, it dies, other pests come in and take over. So you have this pesticide and chemical treadmill, which we have been talking about for a long time, that farmers are on this treadmill and they have to buy more and more chemicals and more different chemicals. This isn't good for them, and it's certainly not good for the insects, and it probably isn't good for our health.
So you, in Rebugging the Planet, you make mention of the fact that 40% of the world's bug populations are in decline, severe decline.
Yeah. That's what is being that's what's being said by the experts. We need to do more research, because a lot of the research is in sort of Western and North, richer countries, where we've got the money to do a lot of the research. But those are indicating, and studies in the Global South as well, are indicating we're seeing massive declines of particularly important species like bees and wild bees. We need to understand this. We need to know more of what's going on. But it's really scary. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I was sitting on a train. I just heard all about these new research that was coming out, long-term trapping by scientists was showing a really long-term decline. And so I thought, well, I could write about this and write about what you can do. And that includes what you can do politically. It's not just what you can do, in your lifestyle and in your everyday life. There's an awful lot people can do.
Yeah, there you go. Well, folks, today we are traveling to jolly old England, London town, to speak with Vicky Hurd. She's the author of Rebugging the Planet, and also with this Alliance for Better Food and Farming. And we're putting a very interesting notion on the table. Should we rebug agriculture, which spends a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of intelligence on getting rid of the bugs? Should we rebug them? A very interesting notion. What do you think? We're at Food Chain Radio Program. We will be right back.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, those bugs do bug us, don't they? They got some mosquitoes in the backyard. You think, how do I get rid of these bugs? And we're doing a pretty good job of getting rid of them. 40% of the world's species of bugs, insects, and whatnot are in a severe state of decline. What happens if we get rid of them all? Vicky Hurd, what happens?
Yeah, we're in deep trouble. I mean, the way in which insects and all the invertebrates are entwined in our lives, you know, they're really critical for our food supply, for what we wear, you know, what we sit on. You know, what are we going to sit on if we've got no trees because the insects aren't providing the pollination, or the worms aren't creating the right soil? It's a very complex web that we're involved in with the insects and the other invertebrates. And, you know, they also clean the water. They're really important. Little rotifers are constantly cleaning water for us. They're converting plant matter and dead bodies into useful nutrients that we can then reuse in our systems. You know, there's just very little in our lives that isn't in some way connected with bugs. And so if we lose them, if we really wipe them out, we're in big trouble. And at the moment, we know about a third of the crops globally are pollinated by invertebrates. And those are things like the fruits and coffee and chocolate, important things like that. All these things are under threat with the decline in bugs. And so we really need to step back from the brink right now and do something with farming that is different. And I know a lot of farmers are doing things differently. There is hope. But we've really got to recognize that we can't carry on like this.
Well, I made mention of the fact that Disneyland scared me when I was a young man. Everything was just synthetic. And I look around my world, and it seems like so much is synthetic now. And if you look at some of the industrial methods for producing our food, they're pretty synthetic too, because they all rely on pretty much bugless environments when it gets right down to it. And they, you know, the industrial methods include many ways of getting rid of bugs. And then it extends right to the food itself, which is becoming less and less and less food as we go along. And I pointed out the Impossible Burger, which is not meat at all. It's just ground up plant matter glued together with, I think, 9 patented chemical compounds so that it looks and tastes like food. So yeah. I see this world evolving into a synthetic Disneyland, and here you take a stand and say it's time to rebug our planet. Yeah. And wow. So, but given all that we do to get rid of bugs, what led you to say, no, it's time to rebug?
Well, I sort of got scared by the stories, you know, the research that was showing bug decline. I do actually love bugs. I always have. When I was very little, I had a load of ants in an ice cream tub, which I looked after for a while until they all escaped. And I've always been fascinated by bugs. So it's something that I carried on through when I did my academic work. And actually, I ended up doing work which was about how to get rid of bugs in a farming system, so pest management. But I decided not to go into the bug-killing business after I left that, and I became an environmentalist working on food and farming. But now, I think it's really serious. I think what we've been led to believe is okay in terms of food, what you're describing, is so ultra-processed. It's so far removed from the land, from the soil, from the nutrients in the soil. It's so far removed from the farmers themselves. We've got, you know, we just have so little contact with farmers, a lot of us. And then we buy heavily processed food, often heavily packaged, which isn't very good for us.
But Vicky, the packages are so colorful.
Yes,
and they say such nice things.
The highly sugar, fat, salty stuff. They know exactly how to do it. They know how to get our taste buds wet, and it's wrong. It's not good.
Not good. And so going back to the bees, The bee says, if we die, we're taking you with us.
Really? Yeah. It's a good slogan, isn't it? I saw it on an Extinction Rebellion march, and I thought it was very good.
And I guess what is hard to understand in a very simple way is the role that insects play in nature. I have come to see them as nature's agents of autophagy, where in addition to pollinating plants, they're responsible for recycling plants.
Yes, absolutely.
Eating up the dead and turning it back into life. And so that's an easy one for us to dismiss because we don't really see that process. I mean, we see the bee and the flower and we think, well, thank you. But we don't see, you know, when the leaf falls to the ground, we don't see it being put upon by all of these insects and microbes and being eaten up.
And worms and, it's an incredible process and brilliant. It's evolved over millions of years in a way which really works for the plants if it's allowed to happen properly. And it allows the plants to grow healthily because they get the right nutrients because they've been released by the microbes that have been able to absorb it because the bugs have queued it up into a form that they can actually access. It's a complex system, but if you think about it, like if you're doing a menu in creating soil, the bugs are often doing the chopping and the grinding and the garlic crushing and all that. They're doing the thing to make it all mush, so the microbes can then do their work and release the nutrients for the plants, which we then eat. And if it's good nutrients, we get good food, but not if it's heavily processed.
Yeah, I was once in the Amazon, Peruvian Amazon, with the Shipibo Indian shaman. He called themselves a curandero. But he was taking us through the jungle and demonstrating the various herbs that he uses for healing properties. But as I was standing there once, I watched a leaf fall to my feet, and I kind of focused in on that leaf. And immediately it was put upon by ants, just went right for it and ate it right up. And I got to thinking, you know, things don't stay dead very long in the Amazon. They just go, it's a constant cycle. And it's the insects and the soil organisms that make that cycle of life possible. And so when we lose that, we've pretty much lost everything. There's one other thing that you mentioned about insects, and that is their how they help us manage water. How does that work?
Yes. Well, a lot of insects and invertebrates, like rotifers, which are tiny little bugs that are the water systems that we use, if they're not using entirely chemical-based, they use the bugs to filter out the particulates and the unhelpful stuff in the water into a form. In the same way with the soil, they're breaking it down into forms that then can be easily removed from the system. Those rotifers, they're called rotifers because they have little hairs on the top that rotate in it like a wheel. And then there's nematodes as well that are used in filtration systems. There's a lot of natural filtration that happens within the water system. But then if you zap it with chlorine and other chemicals to make it safe, then that sort of kills it all off. But we actually do rely on a lot of natural filtration by the invertebrates in the water systems all around the globe. But it depends on the kind of system that your city or your municipality will be using. But they're brilliant at it.
So we invest so much of our time and money and effort in killing all the bugs, getting rid of them, turning everything into Disneyland, as it were, where there are no bugs. And if we succeed, we're going to be in very big trouble because our natural environment will just fizzle up and blow away. So it really behooves us to really give your consideration, your theory here, the rebugging of the planet, a serious consideration. So how do we start? How do we bring back balance to nature? You tell the story about Isabella Tree and Charlie Burrell's 3,500-acre estate. We'll never tell that story because it's really beautiful.
Yes, it's a fantastic story they tell, and it's really amazing what happened. They really did decide to just let nature do its stuff. And in that process, they had some real tricky moments where the whole farm was taken over by thistles. And the farmers nearby were really worried about this, and some weeds and all that kind of problems with your neighbors.
So the neighbors but were all saying, hey, what are you doing? Hey, you're letting the neighborhood
go
to weeds.
Stop it. Exactly. And yet, the next year, an amazing colony of butterflies, which come in very different numbers, different years, but they came in and ate through all the thistles. Nature does have a way, and nature has a way of balancing, which they've found to their joy and a surprise in so many ways. And the bugs in particular were a great surprise to them. So they rewilded a large area, as you say, but you can do small areas too, and farmers can do rewilding to different degrees and see how nature can really help their farm.
Well, nature does have a way of rewilding itself. Mm. I was just down in New Orleans and went out to dinner at a fancy restaurant, and right across the street was an abandoned high-rise, and it had weeds growing right out of the walls.
Fantastic.
I got to thinking, not to be denied, that's the story of nature. But, you know, in thinking about rewilding a commercial dairy farm of some 3,500 acres, I'm sure it was kind of easy to let nature take its course. But then what about what happens to the production of all of that milk and dairy products? If we let nature take over, where does that leave us?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things about that, you know, what will we eat if we rewild? And we've got to remember that we're actually, we're overeating. We're eating too much, and a lot of us are obese in the affluent countries. We're also wasting about a third to 40% of the food that we actually produce. We waste it, we don't eat it, we throw it away. So there's all that to contend with. And we can be overproducing dairy products. So if we don't need so much, we can let some of the land rewild. And they were actually getting subsidies for farming before. And those subsidies obviously were lost when they stopped being a particular farm. But they got other subsidies for doing good things for nature, by rewilding, bringing back species that had disappeared. So there's different ways of getting income and different productivity. So the products are nature and soil and clean air. And also they've made the farm really attractive for people to come and visit and to learn about what's going on and to walk through and to actually stay. They have yurts for people to stay in. So there's a different kind of income, a different productivity, but we can still feed ourselves and farm in ecologically sound ways that do protect nature.
Can we grow enough to feed the world that way?
There are a lot of studies which saying that we can. There was one big study across the whole of Europe which said, it was an independent study with really top researchers modeling if we had an agroecological farming system, which is sort of like organic, really working with nature, diversifying, mixing livestock with the farm, whereas now they're all separate. Livestock are separate from crops. If you did that across the whole of Europe, you could feed yourself if you changed your diet and if we wasted less food. And it could also create more land for nature, sort of rewilded areas, restored nature areas. So it is possible, but we do have to change our attitude to food.
We have to change our attitude. We have to change the way we eat. We have to change the way we farm. Now, how are you going to go about talking farmers who, you know, have become very adept at the industrial model to changing?
Well, one way is already happening, because farmers are actually talking to each other when they're finding their income's continuously under a huge squeeze from a very unrewarding supply chain. The retailers and the caterers are not paying enough for what they're producing. And that's been the case for a long time. So they're starting to get out of that system and sell direct or sell through different friendly traders and talking to each other about how to do things differently. So that's happening, but it's small. Another way is for governments to actually encourage farmers to do things differently by the use of subsidies to actually pay farmers to do things differently. And that we're actually modelling that in England, although it's not really going far enough yet. We're going to be paying farmers for providing public goods like nature, clean water, flood alleviation, all these things government is going to pay for. So that's another way. And another way is through the market. So if customers decide to change what they eat, like eating less and better meat, will actually leave more land for nature, because a lot of meat is fed crops when it could should just be feeding people. And you can eat pasture-based meat, which actually contributes to soil condition. So there's lots of opportunities here. And it's really good to see some farmers already getting on with it and learning how to protect the nature, and particularly the bugs that will help them.
And when you talk about pasture-based meats, what you're talking, of course, is about the practice of feeding ruminants grass. Mm. Which is
grass, a mixed, mixed sward. It's got to be not just grass. It's a whole load of herbs and other things in a diversified pasture-based system year-round.
Just like we're supposed to eat ourselves, right?
Exactly, yes.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Vicky Hurd, who is the CEO of the Alliance for Better Food and Farming up there in England. And when we come back from this break, we are going to continue our conversation about rebugging the planet. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson today with Vicky Hurd in London, England. We're talking about rebugging the planet. Why, Vicky, would we want to rebug the planet?
Well, we have got a lot of problems with the way in which bugs are disappearing from our ecosystems, from the natural systems we need in order to be able to feed ourselves, to have clean water, to have healthy environments we want to be in and have well-being by walking in them and being, you know, healthy air, etc. All those depend on a set of bugs under the ground and above the ground that that mean that we feed the birds and things like that. A lot of bugs are actually food for the birds. If you like birds, we need bugs. And those things are actually under threat by the way that we've farmed for many years. And so we need to change what we eat. We need to help farmers do things differently and really understand the role of the bugs, from the worms to the butterflies, understand them better and why they matter.
So if we like to eat, and if we like nature, and if we like living on the earth, maybe we should think about rebugging the planet. And that's what we're doing today. We're thinking about rebugging the planet. Now, here in the California Central Coast, the salad bowl of the world, as it were, we have trouble with pathogens getting into the food and causing a lot of sickness around the world when it gets right down to it, because our produce goes around the world. Now, to prevent or to slow down the spread of those pathogens throughout the food chain, we've instituted a lot of rules and regulations for the way we do things. And one of those is that we do our best to fence off nature.
Keep out
nature to the extent we can. And yet there are people in the salad bowl of the world who are advocating for putting in hedgerows and making it friendly for birds and whatnot. So we have this wonderful conflict going on. Do you think there is a way for those nature-loving farmers to be able to talk with those industrial farmers about reintroducing nature in a situation where they're scared to death about bugs?
Yes, we've got very terrified, haven't we, of nature, and it's not helpful, because creating the sterile environments, I don't think, gives us good food. But yes, I think one of the best ways for farmers to understand how they can do things differently if they hear about it from other farmers. And I know it can be done, because I see farmers in America and in Britain doing things differently and still making a living, still producing a lot of food. What they're doing a lot of is protecting things and adding natural systems like hedgerows, which can be fantastic refuges for the predators of pests. So the hedgerows host the pest predators, you know, like wasps that will hurt your aphids and things like that. They can all be hosts for those really helpful bugs. And farmers are doing that. They're seeing the benefits, and they're seeing the lowered chemical costs that are involved. And they talk to each other. So that's a really good way. But another way would be for better connection between customers and farmers. So more direct sales. What we've got is a food system which is so complex and long distance. We used to call it food miles, but it's just like we're too far away from our food. And so you can build in more regional and local food systems, still make them efficient, but make them more diverse. And diversity is key. If you've got more crops in a rotation, then bad pests, unhelpful pests, have less chance of taking a real hold of your system, and the good pests can really start to build up. So rotations are key, having those habitats like hedgerows. But a farmer who's doing that will be producing differently. And they might produce, like apples that might have the odd scab on. That's not the end of the world. You could still eat it. So you've got to start to have a different relationship, as I said, with your food, and actually learn from the farmer why they might be doing things differently, why there might be different tomatoes. There's tomatoes that are resistant to a lot of the tomato diseases, but they can't use them because we've got so used to the perfect round bullet, tennis ball, red tennis ball. There are amazing ranges of tomatoes and potatoes and fruits, and we just like rely on one or two varieties which look good, travel well, but don't taste great. So it's starting to have that conversation better, but it does mean a lot of rebuilding of the food systems.
Well, you are a proud campaigner up and down the food chain for bringing real food back into the food chain. And you suggested a way to do that is start with bugs, which probably is right. But there has to be some changing of the minds. Mm. And so I ask, which mind should we start with first, the farmer or the consumer?
Mm. Chicken or egg? That's a very good question. I think, unfortunately, we've got to do both. But the big conundrum is the bit in the middle, the missing middle, the people who buy the food at the farm gate from the farmer and then do loads and loads of stuff to it and then sell it to us. That we can't forget about that bit in the middle. But as I said, ideally, we'd start to have systems where, like farmers markets, where people can connect directly. And your food systems, your way of helping people on low incomes get food, getting it directly from the farmer. Those kind of ways in which you can have both farmer and the consumer talking and learning together. But I think we need it all. And that could come from education programs for consumers, from the government. I know you have a dietary guidelines. We have them in the UK. There should be more than dietary guidelines. There should be eating and where to buy your food from, what to eat, and how that should have been produced, you know, how you should be supporting organic farmers, farmers doing things differently, farmers using fully pasture-based systems, not animals fed on crops. So some sort of education process, but also training for farmers to do things differently. And as I said, farmers can learn from other farmers, but they can learn from advisors. I'm promoting here the idea that we have a really affordable, if not free, advisory system for farmers so they can learn about helpful predators like prey of their pest species. They can learn about rotations, about having cover crops for their soil, which helps the soil remain heavy, protecting all those bugs in the soil and reducing the chemical load on your farm, learning how to do that and not take big crashes in income. So to do it in, you know, steps and ways forward. And that's true, the consumer. The difficulty we have is that bit in the middle. So the less that goes through that bit in the middle, which is so keen on processing and adding value, meaningless value, and packaging and advertising and marketing, all that kind of stuff. That if they reduce that, that will be a good thing too.
The problem with that meaningless middle is that that's where the big bucks are, as I see it. It's where the money is made is in the middle. Is that you take a raw commodity from a farmer and you put it in the whiz-bang machine and it comes out the other end, and then you put it in a fancy package. It's very colorful and it has some very enthusiastic wording to it, and that's where the money is made. You take a penny's worth of product and turn it into 200 pennies worth of sales. So And that money, when collected together, makes for a very powerful weapon in the halls of government. Mm. And so how do you overcome that?
Yes, I talk about that in my book, you know, the millions upon millions that are spent by the agrochemical and the agribusiness and food big food business when they're lobbying your government and your legislators. It's absolutely toxic. We don't have so much here, but we still have a huge influence. And I do explore that in my book because it's really important. It's really part of the picture. And the only way we can really tackle that is by finding alternative routes to market for those farmers. So that's, you know, in terms of the food system, but also getting our legislators to have more power and less need of that lobbying money. And that's a big political question in the US. But if the more people that are actually part of the movement, if more people like write to their legislators, you know, at state or national level, or write and say, I really want you to cut pesticide use, or I really want you to support farmers in a different way. Where's the organic food? Why can't I get good organic? Why can't I get fresh? If you start to have that movement making a big fuss, it can make a difference. And it can get legislators into hot water if they don't act in the interests of people they're supposed to represent. That's part of what rebugging is. I mean, it's not only what you do in your garden and what you eat, it's how you change the system. And you, everybody has a chance to change the system. And it could be that you could change the system by talking to people and getting more people aware, and then they can get involved in campaigns. You know, you've got great NGOs over there that do, you know, campaigns like Friends of the Earth and the Sierra Club and others that are actually powerful advocates for nature, for wildlife and for the bugs. Join with them in demanding change. So, yeah, it's a hard one. But if we also have action at the supply chain end, so people actually start to buy more directly from farmers, that's something I think could be really exciting through alternative systems. And not making the food really expensive. You know, all that processing, you know, end up with something that's just not that nutritiously good for you. Whereas if you buy more direct, or the farmers maybe could get some added value by doing some processing on farm and then charge a bit more, say they pulp apples. And so they're selling you apple juice, or apple puree, which is easier for you to make into a pie or something. But it's minimal processing, and the farmer gets the most whack of your food dollar. There's good things that could be happening there, but it takes investment because these things require infrastructure.
One of the things I came up with a few years ago was this notion of a 2x2 pledge. And it goes something like this. I pledge to spend $2 per day on local food. And I pledge to talk to other people into doing the same thing.
Excellent.
Now, if we all succeed in carrying out our 2x2 pledge, in a very short period of time, we will, without having spent an extra dime, change everything. We will be eating good food, and we will become economically secure, and in that respect, free. And so I call that the 2x2 pledge. So
that sounds great. Yeah, it's a great idea.
I encourage everybody, just $2 a day. We all have to eat, you know. So you take your $2 a day, maybe just once a week or something, $28 a week, and buy some real good food.
Yeah.
And get in the habit of
that. That's such a great idea.
And get in the habit of that. It's going to cost a little bit of extra time because you're going to have to find local food, which means you're going to have to go to a farmer's market or go to the grocer and say, what's local? I want local. And you're going to have to be a little, become a little proactive in that. But in doing so, you can build a whole local economy based on food, which is really what a local economy should be, right?
It should be. And keeping, you know, stopping the leakage of the money out of the local economy and supporting jobs. Some of that might be, you know, pot processing and local marketing jobs that, you know, local farmers could be joining together to produce their food together and possibly do some processing or some sorting, you know, and creating jobs locally. So reducing the leakage out of the local economy. It's all part of a positive system for change. That sounds great. 2x2
pledge. Now, how do we go about reaching down to children who the big processors are not the least bit bashful about reaching and selling them their ersatz, their Disneyland foods? How do we get down there to the kids and reach them?
Yes. Well, I think it does start very much from an early age, because children are so wonderfully curious about bugs. They love bugs because bugs don't look like them. They don't look like anything normal, and they find them fascinating. My children did, all children do. But then as they get a bit older, they hear the fear from their parents, or the parents say, oh, we mustn't have any bugs in this house, or any bugs on your food. That's terrible. Get rid of it. You'll get stung, you know. And then they get the fear, and that fear stays with them forever, and they just think everything's got to be sterile. So it does start with changing your attitude to bugs in front of children that are your children or children you care for, and doing fun things with bugs, like a bug hunt, or, you know, there's things in my book, ideas about how you can get children having fun with bugs and having your relationship being positive in front of those children. So that's one way. But the big issue you're talking about there as well is the massive marketing of junk food to children. And we've been running a campaign at Sustain for many years, and we have got constrictions and laws to stop the advertising and marketing of junk food to children, both on television and online. But it's taken many years. It's quite a big thing. It does take a lot of people. What we did do is a parents' jury. We got hundreds of parents across the country to say what they wanted to do, because they found the marketing, the advertising, wherever they look, you know, McDonald's and, you know, so wherever they look, they saw that advertising. It really doesn't help them to be good food parents. And so they wanted the controls. And so we asked them and we advertised it. We did good campaigns on it, and it's made a difference.
You are a very ardent fighter for good food. Yes. We have to do is rebug the planet. Folks, Vicky Hurd from London, talking about rebugging the planet, her book, and restoring good food. And we love that idea. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. Thank you, Vicky.
My pleasure. Great to talk.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.